democracy being shattered, quite frankly, and there's no justification for the level of violence, full stop, that was on show and has been on display. And people have been assaulted, people have died. The violence, you know, should stop, and he should absolutely condemn everything that has taken place.
In the early hours, Republican Senator Mitt Romney blamed President Trump for inciting a violent insurrection. He also downplayed suggestions of a congressional audit to placate angry Trump supporters.
For any who remain insistent on an audit in order to satisfy the many people who believe that the election was stolen, I'd offer this perspective. No congressional audit is ever going to convince these voters, particularly when the president will continue to say that the election was stolen.
Many predicted unrest, but Wednesday's scenes went beyond expectation. Four people dead, with lawmakers having to cower and abandon the historic building. In less than 2 weeks, President-elect Joe Biden will be inaugurated in the very same building, but with scenes of unrest, authorities will be bracing for more potential chaos, as the world watches the most powerful nation descend into even greater levels of division.
Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, a name that defined Iran's nuclear energy program. The top Iranian nuclear scientist was assassinated in November last year. In terms of who was behind the incident, Iran has from the outset pointed the finger at Israel. Israel has a track record of killing Iranian nuclear scientists since 2010. Fakhrizadeh is the fifth to be targeted. While Iran has revealed that it has tracked down some of those involved in the attack, families of the slain nuclear scientists have separately initiated a lawsuit at Iran's Court for International Affairs, not against Israel, but against the United States, for, quote, systemic support for Israel's terrorist activities against Iran. The lead lawyer of the lawsuit says if the case is certified, Iran can freeze American assets in some countries and transfer them as compensation to the families of the victims.
The families of the slain scientists demand that the masterminds of the attacks be punished. Iran does not recognize Israel as a country, so we filed a lawsuit against the U.S. as the major supporter of Israel's crimes. The case will be reviewed at Iran's Court for International Affairs, and then we will take further legal proceedings at an international scale. This is to relieve part of the pain inflicted on the families of the victims.
Iran says the assassination of its scientists pursues a single goal: to deal a heavy blow to the country's nuclear program. But the emotional side effects are even heavier to bear for the families of the victims. Like 14-year-old Armita, who lost her father when she was only four. She says she will never forgive those who took away her dream. Israel has not commented on any of the assassinations of the Iranian scientists. But as to the last one, it has already spilled the beans on itself. Fakhrizadeh had long been on Israel's hit list. This remark by the Israeli Prime Minister perhaps says it all.
This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
But this time around, Iran was quick to respond. Days ago, the country resumed enriching uranium to 20% purity, surpassing the 3.67% cap set by the 2015 nuclear deal.
While Tehran interprets the elimination of its nuclear scientists as nothing but an attempt to derail its nuclear program, the hunt for those culpable in Fakhrizadeh's assassination is placing the remaining pieces of the puzzle, which observers say is giving stronger clues of an Israeli link to the issue. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
An official ceremony was held at the Assad House for Art and Culture in Damascus, marking the first martyrdom anniversary of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Iran's ambassador to Syria delivered a word condemning the assassination crime and asserting that the Iranian people have taken revenge and continue to do so. He also reiterated his country's ongoing support to the Syrian people and army until the full defeat of terror.
The criminal act perpetrated by the U.S. administration is against all international laws and the U.N. Charter. It is an act rejected by the entire world. The assassination proves the failure of the aggressive plot aimed at supporting terrorism and spreading instability in this region.
The event was attended by a wide range of high-ranking officials. Dr. Buthaina Shaban, who was representing Syria's President Bashar al-Assad in the ceremony, said the U.S. assassinated General Soleimani out of fear of his successful strategy that undermined their plots in the region, stressing Syrians will learn many lessons from the general's life. On the sideline of the ceremony, an exhibition was held shedding light on General Soleimani's life and focusing on his achievements in the fight against terror in Syria and Iraq in the past decade. A year after Lieutenant General Soleimani's assassination, Syrians are clearly keen to demonstrate their respect to his sacrifices for their country. Ceremonies held across the country express the high level of appreciation everyone here has for what the general had offered for the security of Syrian territories. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Following the landslide victory of Venezuela's ruling Socialist Party in last December's legislative election, former Information Minister Jorge Rodriguez has now been appointed as the new Speaker of the Nation's Congress, also known as National Assembly. Rodriguez, who is widely regarded as one of President Nicolas Maduro's closest allies, has claimed that the newly elected Congress will work exhaustively to promote the policies of the country's president. The assumption of Rodriguez as head of parliament puts an end to a five-year-long control of the congressional body by the opposition, through which the spat between the executive and the legislative produced political turmoil in the Latin American Republic. Socialist lawmakers praised the designation of Rodriguez, although in the opposition some complain about the new head of parliament. Nonetheless, experts believe that the new parliament is a politically balanced body now. Now that Venezuela's ruling Socialist Party has regained control of the country's Congress, many believe that President Maduro is more stable than ever in his office. While the opposition has hit bottom in political terms, Jesus Silva, Caracas.
Unemployment rates among Turkish youth have increased dramatically in the recent period, especially after the outbreak of the new coronavirus pandemic. According to the latest figures released by the Turkish Statistical Institute, the unemployment rate was 12.7% in September 2020. Turkish government says reviving economy is among its priorities amid the pandemic. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has vowed not to allow foreign factors negatively affect the country's economy.
It is not possible for a state to survive in long term with rising unemployment. So we have developed various plans to revive our economy, turning it into one of the 10 largest economies in the world by equal distribution of wealth among our population.
As part of efforts to stop declining employment, the government has banned companies from firing employees during the pandemic. So it prevents us from seeing the direct effect of the coronavirus on unemployment. We cannot see it in numbers, but we can definitely see it on the ground. This is how economists explain.
Unemployment is one of the biggest economic problems in the world, and Turkey is no exception. Despite our government's projects to lower the unemployment rates, unfortunately the numbers are rising, especially amid the pandemic that has paralyzed the economic sector.
The government say it plans to lower the unemployment rate to 10.9% in 2023. However, it seems that it all depends on how the country plans to recover from a pandemic and the lira crisis. As observers say, the main strength point of the ruling party has been flourishing economy and low unemployment. And now, with the pandemic continuing more and more, the country is witnessing the ruling party's popularity sliding further. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Huge crowds from Damascus countryside flocked to mark the first martyrdom anniversary of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Held in eastern Ghouta, once a hub for terrorists, residents attended the ceremony to pay tribute as a sign of gratitude for General Soleimani's key role in defeating terror in Syria. Iran's ambassador to Syria condemned the heinous assassination crime, underlining the importance of unity of Muslims against the U.S. and Israeli plots in the region.
They assassinated General Soleimani in a coward way. The crime is against all international laws. They did that because their plans had failed in the region. The assassination only brought them shame and defeat. and will lead to their expulsion from the region.
Speakers praised the general's support to Syria as a key factor for restoring security to many parts of the Arab country.
We have gathered here to honor the memory of Commander Soleimani, who offered Syria valuable services. General Soleimani is a historic hero whose achievements changed the region.
A photograph exhibition was also organized to shed light on General Soleimani's achievements in Syria and Iraq. General Soleimani, assassinated by the U.S. a year ago in Iraq, headed Iranian military advisors in Syria at its government's request, and for years played a pivotal role in defeating terrorism and liberating many towns and villages. In Syria, the memory of General Soleimani reminds everyone of the principles of sacrifice, brotherhood, friendship, and unity. This is just one of many ceremonies held in Syria to commemorate the general and convey a message of respect and appreciation to all his achievements. Hamad Ali, Damascus Countryside.
The executive director of Yemen's petroleum company has held a press conference in the capital Sana'a over Saudi Arabia's blockade. The officials say the company lost over $100 million in 2020 due to the Saudi-led coalition violations and siege, and accused the UN of complicity.
The United Nations is providing cover for the Saudi-led coalition's acts of piracy in international waters, and it bears full responsibility for them. The violations are huge, and the fines we have suffered are immense.
The senior official said nearly 24 petrol ships belonging to Yemen's petroleum company were confiscated by Saudi Arabia in 2020. He said the seizures came despite the fact that the ships all had transit permits from the UN. Yemen's petroleum company said the ships were released after a few months, but Saudi Arabia's quota acts of piracy cost them millions of dollars in delay fines.
The United Nations has become a clear partner in this blockade against the Yemeni people and has come to stand by the coalition of aggression, so it bears responsibility for the humanitarian crisis.
Yemeni officials say the confiscation of ships caused a spike in fuel prices and forced the closure of some services. They also say the delays and lack of fuel pushed the medical sector to collapse and caused a humanitarian crisis. Many people have to wait for days to get fuel for their vehicle and the limited number of petrol stations.
Saudi Arabia's blockade of Yemen has led to the deaths of Yemeni people and is pushing the country further toward what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. This has taken place amid the silence of international organizations. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of Halim, please.
Hi, Kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marcy Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. As the new year continues going forth, the situation in the United States continues to be chaotic and confusing. A few days ago, there was an attack on the U.S. Capitol, and since that time, there have been attacks on free speech and increased censorship as the division inside of the country gets greater and greater. Stay with us as we pick apart the complexities of what is taking place in the United States on this debate.
With just over a week before the departure of Donald Trump from the White House, a public emergency has been declared in the U.S. Capitol, Washington, D.C. That after an unprecedented chaos and the violent storming of the Capitol building by Trump supporters in their efforts to force Congress to overturn the presidential election results. U.S. officials refer to these incidents as days of infamy, accusing Trump of directly inciting the mob to what they call shameful assaults on the American democracy. President-elect Joe Biden called Trump the most incompetent president in the history of the United States.
I've been saying for now well over a year, he is not fit to serve. He is not fit to serve. He's one of the most incompetent presidents in the history of the United States of America.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called Trump a very dangerous person, saying his removal is an emergency of the highest magnitude.
The president has committed an unspeakable assault on our nation and our people. If the vice president and cabinet do not act, the Congress may be prepared to move forward with impeachment.
Pelosi said she has instructed the House to move forward with an impeachment motion if Trump does not leave Oval Office voluntarily. According to U.S. media, Democratic representatives have already prepared a draft article of impeachment that accuses Trump of engaging in high crimes and misdemeanors by inciting the Capitol Hill insurrection. He will be the first American president to be impeached twice by the House. Democrats are not alone in their bid. Some Republicans have also joined their rallying cries against Trump.
The president is unfit, and the president is unwell, and the president must now relinquish control of the executive branch voluntarily or involuntarily.
A recent joint Reuters-Ipsos opinion poll also shows 57% of Americans are in favor of Trump's immediate removal from office. 7 out of 10 of those who had voted for Trump in the November election also decried the recent storming of the Capitol building. Surprisingly, defiant Trump later denounced the violent protests and pledged for a peaceful transition of power. However, hours later, he once again took to his Twitter saying he would not attend Joe Biden's inauguration on January the 20th. Twitter has now permanently suspended his account, saying several of Trump's posts violate the platform's policy against the glorification of violence. Trump says Twitter is banning free speech. With the traditional departure of a sitting president from Washington now off the table, security concerns are growing for Biden's inauguration. Photos and videos emerging from the Capitol seat show the extent of violence American rioters and white supremacists are capable of. Deaths and vandalism at the Capitol show the United States' much-touted slogan of democracy can be easily endangered by its very own citizens.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program, author, social critic, and political commentator Paul Street out of Iowa City, commentator and writer, coordinating committee at Black Alliance for Peace at Net for Freedmen out of Washington, D.C. Thank you both for being with us. We're going to start this off in D.C. With NetFA. Your take on what took place on January 6th and how indicative it is of the great divide that is taking place in the United States.
Well, you know, I think it's also indicative of an inevitable social clash that's been emerging in the world. Right now, I mean, and it's part and parcel, but not, it's just an element of the insustainability of neoliberalism, and also white supremacy and capitalism and neoliberalism, but also white supremacy. In the United States, these things take a particular manifestation because it's a settler colony, and people have to remember that. It's a settler colonialism that still persists. It's not something settler, something in the past where people, pilgrims came and peacefully. It is the sustained injustice and disenfranchisement and oppression of the indigenous people, the enslaved people they were brought here, particularly working class elements of those things. And then when you add the history of it, it's the elements you see that were laying siege on the White House are basically the those, mostly a lot of working class, but also just those who really held on to the most purest sense of white supremacy and racism and entitlement that has always been manipulated in the history of the United States. So the more, and they're more fascist and whatnot. So that's what's happened. And then the double standard now people are talking about is really, there's a lot of details to talk about here, because there is a relationship between law enforcement and slave patrols and things like that, but also white supremacy. And I'll just say this and end my comment here, is that what's not being talked about in the media here, which you would think is a really obvious thing, is that the FBI has found as early as 2006 that organized white supremacy has intentionally infiltrated law enforcement at every level, they say. And it's a document that comes out in the Counterterrorism Division Task Force. And it would explain a lot of the things that they're talking about answering now. This whole thing about it's an assault on democracy. Well, there's never been democracy for colonized people in the United States, working class people. But right now, what's at stake is the fragility of their sham.
Okay.
The democracy that they...
Stay with me, Netfa. Let me get Paul in this discussion. Your assessment of what went down on January 6th at the Capitol.
Well, first of all, I want to say I agree with just about everything I just heard. So I'd like to see him extradited to Iran and pay the price, or Iraq, and pay the price for the Soleimani assassination, which is one of the most epic fascist war crimes of modern times. This man needs to be removed immediately. Instead of going over some of the same things that Netfa just said that I agree with, let me say this guy needs to be removed immediately. Immediately. I don't care if it's 25th Amendment or if it's impeachment, or my preferential way of getting rid of Trump for 4 years. There's always been a mass protest movement that destabilizes this country to the point that it becomes clear that the masses will not allow the continuation of a neo-fascist presidency. I also agree that it is disingenuous and manipulative and deceptive to hear the rhetoric coming out of the neoliberal democratic establishment to the effect of, oh my God, we had a horrible assault on democracy. It was a horrible assault. It was an assault on a bourgeois representative constitutional election. But to say that there was a horrible assault on democracy, and democracy has been sustained intact, you know, this big sigh of relief, democracy lives. This country was not a democracy. It ceased to be a democracy, if it ever was a democracy. It certainly was not a democracy prior to Trump. It's a corporate, financial, and imperial white supremacist oligarchy, okay, a subject to an unelected de facto dictatorship of concentrated wealth, class rule, and empire. And it was under Obama, and it was under George W. Bush, and it was under Bill Clinton, and it was under Ronald Reagan. That has not changed. So what was fought back was an attempted fascist coup, not just an outside bunch of yahoos flying Confederate flags from the South, also an inside job. It's just a coup against a bourgeois parliamentary election.
Paul, while you're saying that, I just want to jump in here. Paul, sorry to interrupt you, but based on what you were saying, do you think that this is sort of a clash, some would say, of the elite that has taken place in the United States and has exposed the hypocrisy that has always been there in this plutocracy, as you said, is really does not fit into the definition of democracy. But what has happened with an individual such as Trump as probably more exposure of the reality that was already there?
Oh, yes, it's a clash within the elites. And the attempts of the Trumpist movement to portray it as a populist working class uprising is very deceptive. And the notion of the Trump base being proletarian has been discredited again and again and again by serious socioeconomic analysis and statistical breakdown. It's just not true. It's a relatively affluent base for this party. Even when they come from poor parts of the country, they tend to be locally rich. And this is, there's an intra-elite conflict here. And that's why I say it's important to understand that to no small extent, this was an inside job. There was clear participation on members of the so-called national security state. If this had been a Black Lives Matter uprising or a left-led uprising or a so-called Antifa uprising, anything associated with the left, there would have been bodies stacked high. These people would have been shot. If you can imagine Black Lives Matter protesters scaling the walls of the Capitol, they would have been shot dead. There was clearly an agreement to let these people in on the part of certain elites.
Well, Netfa, what about that? An inside drive, inside job, as Paul is saying. I want to talk about that side of things because we all know that the U.S. police very well equipped and not it doesn't really take much for them to shoot, of course, depending on how the individual looked. But what we saw on Wednesday was probably quite unbelievable as far as the lack of security. So some analysts are saying definitely inside cooperation, inside job to let what happened happen. I want your take on that first.
I think there's no question about that. There's footage showing police officers letting people through some in some areas through the barricades that they had there. Even what I just mentioned, the FBI report, and this is an intelligence that they've been gathering on white supremacist organizations, finding out that, you know, that they have infiltrated every aspect of law enforcement. Now, this infiltration part is a little complicated because they actually, this is not a new thing, and they actually share so much in common as the settlers, you know, as settlers have been collaborating ever since the Black Power movement and against the 60s, COINTELPRO, all that, with the Klan forces in the South and everything. So it's not really an infiltration, having to infiltrate like we know it, but in terms of the organized, the most extreme fascist-thinking elements of that, because I would say that the U.S. is white supremacist, but the more organized, blatant forms have actually organized to infiltrate everything. And the FBI has known this. There's no way that we all know the surveillance and every capabilities they have. The report suggests that they know certain things. So that means that even those who are inside and protecting the White House, the courts, everything, have had to have elements within the apparatus that is supposed to secure the White House. And so that's you know, par for the course. But then there's also the fact that those who may not be a part of it are at least establishment enough. They wouldn't agree with anything that me and Paul are saying right here about the composition or what defines this country, but they would be put in a position of having to, you know, they have no problem, you know, unleashing weapons against us and firing us if we're protesting. But in this instance, this was a different element. And some of them, I believe, are even afraid of this element because they know that they come there armed. They know they have enough intelligence, surveillance intelligence, to know that we don't come with guns, did everything that we can lately. But there, those people have pipe bombs and arms. They knew, they had to know that was part of the makeup.
Okay. Well, Paul, speaking about that inside cooperation, there are two different perspectives about that. One, as other guests has just said, basically, because of individuals having the same type of perspective, a fascist perspective, but they're in positions of power, that they actually allowed this. There's another perspective that says, as a matter of fact, the other side of the coin wanted this situation to deteriorate in the way that it has so that it could initiate a massive crackdown, massive censorship that may start off with Trump and his supporters, but like the Patriot Act, will never go away. Your take on that side of things?
Well, I'm not sure it's either or. I mean, the white nationalism and the fascistic sentiments of the white police forces in this country is well documented. And so I wasn't at all surprised to see Capitol Police officers taking selfie photos with the Confederate flag waving proto-fascists. I expected that. I myself have participated in numerous Black Lives Matter, George Floyd protests and have been tear gassed and suffered baton hits and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, I know all about the police. They're behaving as we expected them to. The police, the white police, they were frothing. They were hoping that there would be a Trump coup. That Biden's victory would have been more narrow, and then there would have been a Trump coup, and then there would have been mass uprisings in the cities, and the white cops were just frothing and ready to suppress those protests that they expected against. Unfortunately for them, Biden's margin was too high for Trump to pull that off. At the elite level, I think it's fairly clear. You know, the full history of this will come out as time goes on. But I think it's fairly clear at the elite level that Trump folks were hoping. They're not very competent and they're not very smart. They are fascists, but they're not competent fascists. They were hoping to spark enough mayhem to justify the invoking of the Insurrection Act and the Declaration of Martial Law, and hopefully putting a state of emergency, suspending the inauguration of Joe Biden. That's what they would have liked to have occurred. They don't have the capacity, the chutzpah, or the resources to do something like that. But if it was closer, if this election had been closer, I don't doubt for a second that would have happened, something along those lines, and that we'd be looking at 4 or more years of Trump.
Netfa, where are we at this point in time? Because there have been now some arrests made, and Trump is being controlled on social media along with his followers. But the divide is definitely there, and it doesn't appear that it's going to go away anytime soon. I mean, many of the Trump followers are saying that they're going to be back there in D.C. on Inauguration Day. Your assessment of the situation at this point in time, how deep is this schism right now in the U.S.?
I think it's deep, and I think it's a little even more complicated than what these forces we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. We'll go back and mention this term ghost skins. I forgot to mention that the fascist path of stealth is what the FBI report. But back to your question is that that schism won't go anywhere. This is an element that is, like, you know, we've been saying, that is dead set on having the world order that they want. It's maybe more kinder and less kind imperialism and white supremacy dominating the world. But we're also seeing on the neocon democratic side of this, the things that they're imposing on Trump won't fare well for our movement that is trying to see some real radical human rights changes in this country. So we're seeing, even through Google and Twitter and Facebook, which is really the privatization of thought and conversation and discourse, them leveling that against them is the same thing that they will have in plan for us. In fact, this has just been part of the plan. So there are going to be some consequences here that people will actually be consenting to, measures that will be adverse to a real people-centered movement that's for peace, justice, and anti-racism and anti-patriarchy and all those kind of things. So we have to be very careful. I think it's setting us up for a much more different form of fascism that will be leveled against us, neoliberalism, or the more, I don't know, the less blatant, but also setting us up to consent to it.
Well, at the end of the day, doesn't it give Paul more control once again to the 1%? Because whether we're talking about big tech, are we talking about these politicians who are representing the 1%? At the end of the day, with everything that's happening, it's against the average American. Again, it's to profit empire.
Well, you know, and that's right. And I don't really actually, though, fully expect a serious crackdown on the right. And it is a fascist right. 43% of the GOP approved of the coup attempt. Trump still has an approval rating of support from 4 in 10 Americans. These militia units are going to continue to exist. They're not going to really crack down on them. And part of that is that at the end of the day, what the neoliberal Democrats don't like to admit is that their real fear is to their left. It's not to the right. And in fact, I think they think the right. I think Trump's probably going to walk free. And a lot of these militias are going to be allowed to run around. And I think the neoliberal Democrats kind of like having the right around, because it makes them appear better in comparison. They get to look like the nice cops vis-a-vis the bad cop fascist. Mm-hmm. And they are fascist, Republican Party. But they also get to use the right wing to discipline the people they really hate, which is the left wing, which is
okay.
They love it.
Okay, stay with me. I'm just about out of time. Let me get one question back in there with Netfa. close to a civil war in the United States? Do you see that as a possibility?
That question seems to relate to what Paul just said, that I won't, but they fundamentally believe in the same thing. They weren't really trying to overturn the system and institute justice, universal health care, all these kind of things. And so I think that a civil war in that sense, the only civil war I can see them waging is against the people. We're the ones that are demanding more human rights and justice on every level, real elections that don't have electoral college and all that. That's the threat to the ruling class.
Okay.
And, that's what complicates things.
All right. And thank you both for being with us. Sorry, we're out of time. Author, social critic, and political commentator Paul Street out of Iowa City, and commentator and writer, coordinating committee, Black Alliance for Peace, Netford Friedman out of Washington, D.C. And as always, we appreciate you joining us for another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and all the people right here in Tehran. Hope to see you next time.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
By manufacturing an oil crisis in Yemen, Saudi Arabia is able to foment political chaos in the country and stir up popular discontent against domestic oil companies, says Ahmad Abdul Karim, writer, in an article published under the heading, A Manufactured Crisis, How Saudi Arabia Uses Oil to Bring Yemen to Its Knees. Stay tuned for the details, please. Yemen's oil is enthralled to a complex, intertwined network of elites that control the smuggling of fuel imports and new thriving black markets. Starving Yemen of petroleum products has always been a conspicuous feature of Saudi Arabia's nearly six-year-long invasion of the country. However, the most recent blockade is significantly more extensive than previous ones and comes at a time when a pandemic, diseases, and hunger are spreading rapidly across Yemen. The most recent byproducts of that blockade, the spread of schistosomiasis, a faltering economy in areas outside of Saudi control, and a dangerous new black market. Known colloquially as snail fever, schistosomiasis is a rare disease caused by flatworms that thrive in untreated water, something now abundant in Yemen, as the diesel fuel needed to power many of the country's water treatment facilities, especially those in rural areas far removed from any electric grid, has dried up amid the blockade. In a remote village in Al Marwa district, Khaled Abdo looks at his thin daughter, 12-year-old Jamila, with heartbreak as she lies still in the family's hut. Jamila is suffering from abdominal pain, diarrhea, and blood in her stool. Khaled said she has worms in her stomach, now distended and bloated in stark contrast to her otherwise meager frame. Jamila was later diagnosed with schistosomiasis, according to her family, leaving her with just 3 to 10 more years of life if she doesn't receive proper medical care, a luxury in her war-torn country. As the war in Yemen closes in on yet another grim milestone, the end of its sixth year in March, oil-rich U.S. ally Saudi Arabia continues to prevent oil tankers from delivering much-needed fuel to hospitals, water pumping stations, bakeries, cleaning trucks, and gas stations, plunging the entire nation into an unending fuel crisis. The CEO of Yemen Petroleum Company, Ammar al-Adrai, told Min Press that at least 9 tankers have been trapped in Saudi Arabia's Jizan port, which sits on the kingdom's western seaboard, painfully close to the Yemeni border. The tankers, al-Adrai says, have been held despite being checked and issued permits by both the Saudi-led coalition and the United Nations. He confirmed that the vessels are loaded with oil derivatives and that some of them have been detained for over 9 months, leading to the suspension of more than 50% of the operational capabilities in the service, health, industrial, and commercial sectors. That lack of fuel has caused an acute shortage of even the most basic goods. Khaled told Min Press that the price of fruits, vegetables, and medicine is skyrocketing and my farm is defenseless against desertification. Like many farmers, Khaled, who like his daughter Jamila shows symptoms of malnutrition, is unable to power the pumps needed to irrigate his fields, leaving him unable to grow his own food with which to feed his family and the desert sands encroaching on his now derelict fields. At least 80% of Yemen's 28 million strong population is reliant on food aid to survive in what the United Nations has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and the decimation of the remaining agricultural sector is likely to increase that figure. The Yemeni government is indifferent and apathetic to the suffering of citizens, even in areas under their control, Khaled said, accusing the Saudi-backed government of Aden of deliberately compounding the suffering through the proliferation of the black market. Fuel shortages in the northern provinces are caused by the blockade, but in Aden we don't understand what's going on. By manufacturing an oil crisis in Yemen, Saudi Arabia is able to foment political chaos in the country and stir up popular discontent against domestic oil companies. As a sort of grim bonus, the manufactured oil shortages also to incapacitate the port of Hodeidah, increasing poverty and unemployment rates and siphoning cash out of the market, according to the Yemen Petroleum Company, YPC. YPC released a statement placing the estimated economic damage caused by Saudi Arabia's refusal to allow tankers to unload their cargo at billions of U.S. dollars. The company also said that the demurrage fees are now at an unprecedented level of nearly $107 million and that Saudi forces have illegally impounded 72 Yemen-bound oil tankers last year, resulting in an approximately 45% drop in the amount of desperately needed fuel shipments arriving at Yemeni ports. The fuel blockade has not only forced thousands of Yemenis to wait for days in lines as far as the eye can see, but it has also left water pumps and treatment plants and hospital generators without fuel. Most drinking water, particularly in rural areas, is extracted using diesel-powered pumps, while the country's sizable refugee population survives on water brought by diesel-powered trucks. food imports, which generally arrive via one of the country's ports, are processed and packaged at diesel fuel-powered facilities, factories in Hodeida or Aden, before being transported across the country or sold locally. Outside of the country's coastal cities, where more than 60% of the population resides, freight is transported by road, leaving remote communities at the mercy of trucks that must traverse roads pockmarked and damaged by airstrikes. The few who are willing to undertake the dangerous journey must contend with the high price and scant availability of fuel, pushing the price and availability of even the most basic commodities, including food, water, and medicines, through the roof. The oil crisis in Yemen certainly isn't new, but it has been growing worse recently amid a black market boom, which is adding to the already miserable quality of life for Yemenis. The Saudi regime is flooding southern areas of Yemen under its control with cheap fuel, exacerbating regional tensions and creating an ideal environment for black market petroleum products to boom. The stark disparity between the availability of fuel in Saudi-controlled areas versus areas under Ansarullah control is also causing predictable economic damage to the latter, which is unable to compete amid the Saudi-imposed blockade. Despite the suffocating siege on the country, petrol products are sold illegally on roadsides, streets, and isolated areas in the south and north of the country alike, often at double the official price, with prices in some areas reach 11,000 riyals for 20 liters. These black market petrol products are mixed with water and other materials and enter from Saudi-controlled ports in Aden Port and border crossings such as Al-Wariya, Al-Sahar, and the rich oil Ma'rib province. Yemen's oil is now in large part controlled by a complex network of corrupt officials that control the smuggling routes, imports, and black market sales. Many members of these elite groups are also key allies of Saudi Arabia and the UAE regimes. They not only plunder the wealth and destroy the economy, but they put people's lives and property in danger. People are now forced to seek their fuel from shady black market dealers and store fuel in their homes to get them through tough times. Smuggled petroleum products are sold in residential areas and on licensed storefronts that do not meet security and safety standards and exacerbate the human cost of the crisis.
Iran, IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.